Greetings and salutations, everyone. This is AC2GS. My name is Roy, and I'm net control operator for the Limark Technical Net. Limark Technical Net has been going on for almost 43 years now. Every Sunday night at 8 p.m., we sit down in front of a radio, and we try and teach each other and learn from each other and amuse and entertain each other. So I thank everyone who showed up tonight on this Super Bowl Sunday. Other people are watching a bunch of millionaires traumatize their brains, large incidents of chronic concussion syndrome in the NFL, unfortunately. But I'm appreciative of everyone who's sitting out there listening to me during this. So let me drop for a second, and I will give you our usual link. Okay. If you are interested in contacting me and you can't do it on the radio, then email is a good idea. I have an email address specifically for this, and there's a bunch of different reasons. We accept what we used to call mailbag questions. These are questions that people would have been able to get onto the radio Sunday night after 8 p.m. for whatever reason. They can't make it, so they send the questions via email. We try and answer it as best we can, and they either listen to an audio stream, which we'll talk about soon, or they go to an archive site and play the audio. So that's the mailbag question. Another thing is topics for discussion. Occasionally someone is well-versed in a particular topic that gets into the news, and they like to do a short presentation on it and ask, and I'm more than happy to provide the time and the audience. Sometimes people want to be part of a discussion. That's fine, too. Other times people are curious about a subject but don't feel that they know enough to warrant them being involved. They would like to hear other people talk about it. So if you have any topic to suggest, feel free through the email. Also, I like puzzles. I try and collect them. They are very few and far between and rather rare, and too often they're answerable by a simple Google search, which defeats the purpose, because I feel it's not exactly the destination, but the journey that counts the most. And we've had some very interesting journeys through a puzzle. So if you have a technical puzzle, please share it with me, and if I think I could work it in the right direction for this technical net, I would be happy to use it. Also, if you want me to tap Paul on the shoulder, if you have a story, either a YouTube or a blog about NASA or space-related, and you want his opinion, you can either contact him directly at spacenetreport@gmail.com, or you can contact me, and I will contact him. So my email address is, for the purposes of this, mailbag@ac2gs.com. I say again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. I have a link page available. It has a lot of interesting articles and YouTube. Right now at the very top is a brand new shiny YouTube that has our own Andy WA2CDL down in Florida at the Hamcation. Someone interviewed him, and I have a link for it, so you can go to my link page and see that. Also, Okay, don't want to time out the repeater now, do we? I also have the Further Adventures of Artificial Intelligence. Last week I showed on my link page what a graphic AI thinks a antenna is. They have no idea, apparently. They were not programmed with the slightest knowledge of what a Yagi is, what a center-fed dipole is. And so I've been feeding specifications to graphic AI programs and receiving complete abstract nonsense. So in this week's version, I go to yet another graphic AI program. The previous one was Stable Diffusion. This one is called Midjourney. It's very, very popular among artists, or AI artists, whatever you would call them. And this program doesn't have the faintest idea what a Yagi is either, but you can take a look at the abstract images that it generates when I ask for a three-element Yagi perched on the top of a radio tower. It's an intriguing set of possibilities. Let me drop for a sec. Okay, we have a chat room available. Lately it's been kind of quiet, but occasionally it gets very, very raucous and loud and interesting. A lot of cross conversation takes place sometimes. You can reach it by typing into your browser URL chat.ac2gs.com, and that'll take you to the chat room. We have an audio stream that I provide for the technical net on the internet. So if you don't have a radio or you're out of radio distance, you can't get into Echolink for whatever reason, then you can type into your browser technet.ac2gs.com, and that'll give you a live link to the Glen Oaks repeater. And I only put it up for the technical net, but because a few people asked for me to leave it on the rest of the week, most of the time during the week, if you can't get to the repeater via your radio, you can again just type in technet.ac2gs.com, and that'll give you a feed for the Glen Oaks repeater. Also, want to remind people, Mike, KC2NJI, has an archive site. It's called amateurradio.tv. Has over a million visitors, and it has the archives of the Limark Technical Net as far back as September of 2006. So please check it out. There's a lot of wisdom from many hams. Some of them are still around, thankfully, but others have moved away or have become silent seas. So keep that in mind. It's a endless source of advice and knowledge from some of the smartest hams that I've ever heard. So that's my links. Let me drop for a second, and I'll tell you what I got planned. Okay. We will be asking people if they have any questions or topics tonight. I would prefer the first few to be amateur radio related. It is an amateur radio technical net, but we will take any kind of question, scientific, medical. We do not treat a diagnose over the radio, but any subject that's science-related, we will try our best, and hopefully we have some very clever people out there who will teach me a thing or two. So that'll go until hopefully about 10:15, and Paul, WS2N, will bring us a SpaceNet report. And maybe he'll have some discussion about those balloons that we keep finding in the air and shooting down. It's made the New York Times, so that's a good thing to discuss, maybe. Anyway, that's my plans for tonight. So I will drop the repeater and ask anyone who would like to offer any questions, topic for discussion or comments, to tell me their call sign and their first name.
82AMZ, I've made an interesting discovery about power supplies for QRP I'd like to share with the group.
Sure, Mike, you're on the list. Anyone else want to be on the list tonight? Okay, Wes, you're down on the list. Anyone else want to put their name up on the list for tonight?
WS2N about the DX position to Bouvet Island.
Okay, Paul, you're on the list. Once again, anyone else out there want to put their name on the list? We'll take names later on, but the sooner you get put on the list, the sooner it's likely we won't kind of go down a rabbit hole and call your name at 10:10 in the evening, and you'll be long gone. So if you want to put your name down, please do now.
KD2VHD, Jim.
Jim recognized, you're on the list. One more time, if anyone else wants to put their name on the list for tonight, please give me your first name and your call sign. Okay, very good. We have four people. That should take us through the whole night, but hopefully there'll be some more activity later on. Mike, KD2AMZ, you want to tell us about power supply?
Yes, I do. I made an interesting discovery this weekend on YouTube, of all places, and I see a perfect application for this for a QRP rig. A USB port is capable of producing 5, 9, 15, and 20 volts with the use of what's called a trigger, a PD trigger. In other words, USB is not just a plug for your cell phone that you can put in either direction. If you use this thing called a trigger port, you plug a USB-C to a USB-C and to a power pack, as long as the power pack is rated for PD, Papa Delta, you can program this thing to make 5, 9, 12, 15, or 20 volts, up to about 5 amps. Now, that's plenty of power to run a QRP rig. So you can run a QRP rig off of basically a standard USB power pack. I thought that was pretty neat.
Okay, thanks for sharing that, Mike. There are a couple of things I'd like to add to that. USB, unfortunately, comes in a whole bunch of different flavors. It's less complicated if you stick with a power supply that has a C connector to it, because that tends to mean that it's operating with USB 3 or 3.1. USB-A, the old-fashioned one that we all know and love, are capable of 3.1 and capable of similar power delivery capability. That's what the PD stands for. Some aren't. It's one of those charming little things where they shake hands, the circuits, the chips, will shake hands with the two components, and if it's capable of operating at higher voltages and higher currents, it will give approval, so that you don't want any kind of connection to immediately give you the higher current and higher voltage. You would burn out some sensitive components. So there's a little bit of handshaking that goes on. Also, what's important is to know the power handling capacity of that power supply. There are USB-C power bricks that are low power, and they simply won't provide the amount of watts that are necessary. So it's always a good idea to make sure that the power capacity of the USB power supply is enough to power things. You know, nowadays, they're using relatively new technology. They're using gallium nitride, which is able to create far more powerful power supplies in smaller, more efficient containers. So there's a lot of high power bricks that are very not brick-like anymore. They've shrunken them in size. And we've all seen power supplies for our little devices shrink down to next to nothing, and that's partially due to the gallium nitride technology.
Well, copy that. I agree. You just expanded upon what I was reading and studying this weekend. Yes, it's an interesting concept. Get yourself a power pack. It can operate QRP, a little trigger board, and they're only about 5. I've seen them. I just checked out YouTube. I mean, not YouTube. Like an Amazon, what's the other one, eBay, and you get it for a few dollars, and you can construct yourself a really neat power supply for QRP. Obviously, you need to, check what you're buying. I just think it was a very intriguing concept.
Thank you for visiting the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England Reflector.
Link clear.
Yes, Mike, I agree with you. Buyer beware, though. You should make sure that these things are compatible with each other. I don't know if you're familiar. I use Wi-Fi mesh networks instead of just an access point and a couple of other access points with different names through the house. Mesh Wi-Fi systems use the same identifier, and so you don't have to disconnect from one Wi-Fi and connect to another. If they behave the way they're supposed to, they can switch to the closer mesh Wi-Fi. It's an Eero. It was bought up by Amazon, like eventually everything probably will be. And it had a curious problem. I bought a brand new one. There are a few different generations of Wi-Fi that they've made these Eeros for, And they all get powered by a USB connector coming from a USB-C power supply. And I tried, for the heck of it, to plug in my old USB-C power supply to the brand new Aero, but because the brand new Aero apparently requires a different power handling capacity that was beyond the old USB-C power supply, it would not boot the Aero. I had to actually swap the power supply that looks almost identical, that uses C as an interface with the new one, and it booted up fine. So that's the problem, apparently, with power delivery systems. You're never quite sure, and it's not well documented which PD protocols any given power supply is capable of utilizing. It's unfortunately more a case of trial and error. You know, there's no place to look on the label. You just have to plug things in, see if they power up, and if they don't, try another USB-C power supply.
Comment?
Okay, well, I'm going to let it drop because other people need to talk. What I'm trying to say, it's an intriguing idea. Yes, I also use a mesh in my home. It's an intriguing idea. Yes, buyer beware. You know, and I've noticed that they do have them. I just checked the battery pack, not the wall warts, but the battery packs, and they do say PD on them. Whether it has 5, 9, 15, or however it goes, that is anybody's guess. But all I'm trying to say, yes, buyer beware, intriguing concept, quite interesting. Anyways, back to that.
Okay, I agree with you, Mike. Like I said, that's the problem. The problem is there are so many different power delivery protocols that, and I don't think they have any kind of code. So, unfortunately, it's more of just plugging it in and trial and error, because it might be capable of all the PD power delivery protocols, but because they add them as future iterations to chipsets, you're never quite sure which chipset your device has. It's almost akin to the bad old days. A lot of us have equipment that takes SD cards, but because they're multi-generational, we don't quite know what their capacity is. There are SD card reader chips that will only read 32 gigabytes and below. So if you buy a nice new shiny a half a terabyte SD card and plug it into, say, my Icon 7100, it could only use 32 gigabytes of that 500 gigabyte thing. So that's one of the little problems that our modern accelerated technology offers us, that there's a lot of undocumented limitations and capabilities that you know, you just have to try on your own. But thanks for suggesting that. I think that's a very, very good new bit of information. It's not that ubiquitous that the availability of PD decoding type of chips, but yeah, that certainly is a interesting way of utilizing modern day power supplies for QRP operations. I would agree.
Comment?
Yes, Wesley.
Yeah, thank you very much for interesting information. I have some addition to it in regards to the chipset and in regards to the power. Are there electrical outlets that have...
This is KA.
...that could be mounted in a wall bar and they have one or two or few USB ports. Usually there are USB 3. Well, not necessarily. USB 1, 2. Okay. But they have a limitation, 18 watts. And I was wondering why is 18 watts. And I've read that USB ports deliver combined power of 18 watts, while you get 12 watts of electricity if you just use one port. The outlet also features a smart chip that recognizes your device charging requirement and optimizes the charge. So when you take divide 18 watts by 12, get 1.5 of amp that is available. How it makes 5 amps
is
probably because you have a lower voltage than you have a higher current to fulfill the kilowatt. But our radio works on 12 volts per deal.
Okay. Unfortunately, you were kind of doubling. I'm not quite sure who you were doubling with. I'm thinking maybe occasionally we have these odd little air link linkages, and so maybe there's an air link node that's live on our repeater. Let me just find out. If there is anyone who was kind of talking, just as Wesley was talking, might not have heard Wesley. Could you talk again, just to make sure this is a two-way connection as opposed to a one-way leak on the AirLink?
Well, I had the station just as you were talking in the beginning, but then he went away. I can't, you know, I'm not sure what he was saying. You overwhelmed him where Wesley did it.
Okay, that's curious. I don't know what to quite make of that. The last time something similar like this happened, it was because we're now kind of linked up on all kinds of different ways. We're IRLP, we're EchoLink, and we're also AirLink. And I think the very first time it was all established, there was bleed through from some node on AirLink that we were just listening into. But I don't know. We'll see. Getting back to what Wesley talked about, there are most likely current limitations of the USB-A connectors. I know USB-C connectors can power laptops. You know, everyone is very proud of they can fast charge and probably decrease the battery life of iPhones and such, but they could also can carry enough power to charge up a full-size laptop. So C connectors certainly have far more than a 12 or an 18-watt limitation. I'm not quite sure what the limitations inherent to a USB-A connector. You see, unfortunately, that's another confusing aspect. USB has different names for all the connectors. The one that we know and love is an A male, there's an A female, there's a B, of course there's a C, there's a mini that was used for about a year or two until there was a lot of mechanical failures and it was phased out for the micro USB. So there's a lot of different connectors and also there's a lot of different protocols. The first USB obviously was 1.0. Most of our lesser USB devices are 2.0. And usually when you buy a computer, you have 2.0 ports and 3.0 ports or 3.1 ports and one or two now C ports that are 3 or 3.1 protocols. So it's a real complicated mess. And sometimes, unfortunately, although you should be able to plug any device into a USB 3 or 3.1, some people advise that for some legacy devices, do not confuse it too much and plug it into a 2.0 port. You can tell the difference between, because 3.0 and 3.1, the little plastic tab inside is colored blue usually.
We're talking about maximum power from USB ports in the outlets, or plug-in outlets, 18 watts. But you get 12 watts if you use one port if you have many of them. So the outlet has built-in smart chip that recognizes charging requirements and optimizes the charge. Okay. So the problem was that if you divide 18 watts, which is the maximum for it, by 12 volts, which is our QRP, then you get 1.5 amp. To buy an entire rig. But then you have the chip that optimizes the charging. So the question is, how far it is that for QRP at ham radio operation?
Well, you would need more, but when you're talking about that, I think you're talking about the specifications for USB 1 and USB 2. They may not be the same case for USB 3 protocol.
Well, so far I didn't see USB 3 or USB-C in outlets, electrical outlets, or plug-in secondary electrical outlets that have USB ports.
Well, I don't know. It depends upon the chipsets that are used. But USB, you don't have to have USB-C. You can have 3.0 or 3.1 protocol using the old-fashioned USB A connectors. And like I said, the way to tell the difference between a USB 1 or 2 version of USB A connectors and the 3 or the 3.1 is all these USB devices have a spacer, a plastic spacer built into them so that you can't rotate the connector 180 degrees. It's not a symmetrical connector, but the little black plastic is usually black, sometimes white, for 1 and 2, but it is almost always a deep blue for 3 or 3.1. So I'm not sure of it. But I think that perhaps USB 3 is capable of more, although I don't know if it's implemented in outlets. It might be just implemented in separate power supply, little power wards that you plug into the outlet.
The thing is that from perspective of ham radio operator who wants to connect a QRP, to it, it's much cheap interferes because it's made for matching the charging requirements of the charge cycles or optimizing it for the battery for the cell phone and portable devices, not for use with 12 volts power supply. Not serve as a 12 volts power supply for any device, including ham radio, QRP.
Okay, well, I don't know whether it's viable. I know USB power delivery protocols will allow for a maximum power output, at least the last time I looked, of 100 watts, and capable of putting out 5 volts, 9 volts, 15 volts, which, you could probably put a little voltage regulator and bring it down to about 13 volts and 20 volts. Usually the maximum current on any of those voltages is about 5 amps. So that seems to be the protocol for USB power delivery, which is tends to be kind of seen in, as I said, 3.1. And, you know, I mean, it even compounds the problem. Not only is there a 3.1 protocol, but there is a, unfortunately, 3.1 Generation 2 protocol. So you can kind of drown yourself in all these little sub-protocols that are not well documented. But there do exist protocols that would supply, in my opinion, the necessary power for more than QRP levels. Not much more, but more than QRP levels. So it's probably possible to do it. I would be interested in hearing of people try it and see what they get from it.
One more addition. So, the thing is that if we have a QRP that takes 0.6 amp for the receiver out of 1.5 watt at 12 volts, if you use the device that is suggested by a friend ham radio operator, then how much power are you going to generate? Another 0.7 watts altogether. So, let me say, isn't it better just to get a 12 volt transformer that has 5 amps on it and plug it into the outlet if you have one? And to exchange.
Well, I mean, as far as USBs and outlets, I don't know how many people out there actually have them. I have seen them advertised. I have not particularly ever been interested in bothering to do that. It strikes me, especially due to the changeability of USB protocols, that if you go to the trouble and you swap out your outlets for one that includes USB, you'll have to do it again next year, or the year after, or the year after, or the year after, because they keep on upgrading the damn protocol. So what I've always done, and I think 95%, if not more, of the population, is rely on power bricks, Woolworths, and such, and just plug those via the regular AC and go from there. So if you happen, and some people already have power supplies that are capable of PD protocols. They're used to fast charge iPads, as I've mentioned. They're used to charge your laptop. There are my USB-C connector. It happens to be even more confusing, not only a 3.1 USB protocol, but also something called Thunderbolt, which is a completely separate protocol that Intel owns, and is capable of fully charging my Lenovo desktop. It's also capable of passing video signals and operating a multifunction dock full of audio circuits and USB interfaces and video interfaces as well. So just because it looks like a USB-C doesn't necessarily tell you exactly what it is. It could be a USB 3.0, a 3.1, a 3.1 Generation 2, or a Thunderbolt 1 or 2. And it just gets more and more confusing.
Are you talking about power bridge, which is called power bridge? I'm reading it's 12 volt, 9 volt, 5 volt, 3.3 volts, both positive and negative. Designed to directly plug broadband for simple for low profile integration. Reading, it is 5 volt at standard USB and has a VIN pin also, but it gives 1.1 watts of power. Is the one that you're talking about?
Not necessarily. Something that supplies 1.1 watts is not going to charge my my laptop. As I said, as my understanding, a USB PD protocol can go all the way up to a 100 watt maximum power supply. It depends. If you want to call it a power brick, if you want to call it a Woolworth, a rose is a rose is a rose. In the old days, the volume necessary for a high wattage power supply that can charge a legitimate full-size laptop would be about as big and heavy as a brick. But those things have shrunk precipitously with gallium nitride technology, so they're not as brick-like as they once were. But once again, I'm just telling you what I understand the PD protocol to suggest, that you can bring it as far up as 100 watts, which is more than enough to charge a laptop. I wouldn't want to try and charge my laptop with a power supply capable of a little bit over 1 watt.
Thank you very much for that. My suggestion is the in the film industry, which you can buy in B&H, in Manhattan, right? They have a power bricks or similar device like that has USBs, that has a rant output connector or whatever connector you wish to have, and they use to power cameras, monitors, portable monitors, and the focus adjusters with motors and whatsoever. They have a quite good power. It depends from the model and manufacturer, and then they can deliver 60 watts, 100 watts, 500 watts if you want to. Not big in and not very much heavy, as they have to be carried on with the camera. So that would be my 5 cents to the subject. Thank you.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Wesley. Yeah, I mean, there are all kinds of power supplies. I mean, I have my own lovely little Tenma It's a 60 amp power supply for amateur radio equipment. I've been using it for over a decade, and it's never let me down. But there are a lot of power supplies out there. Just as an aside, you mentioned the B&H. Nice place, decent place. I buy a significant amount of stuff from them. For people out there who are unaware, this is not an ad for B&H because I don't own any stock in it. They have a nice little thing going where in the old days they didn't ask you to pay sales tax. And I think the dodge that they did was they shipped it from New Jersey. So because it was an interstate shipment, they could kind of lose the taxes and such. The Supreme Court changed that rule so that every state has to respect the other state's sales tax. So they set something up with a credit card company, apparently, that if you purchase items through their credit card for their company, they actually discount the sales tax. As long as you actually pay the credit card when it comes due and you don't wait for it to accrue interest, it could save you a couple of bucks. So if you're out there and it's a video or photographic type of toys, and you find that places like B&H Photo have what you want, you might want to take advantage of that sales tax saving feature that they offer. Just my two cents worth out there.
I'm confused. If I buy it for my company, I buy it with reseller tax credit. So then when I pay my sales tax that I collect from the client, I have to collect the tax for both the device that I have purchased plus my labor and other expenses. That's what my invoice. So then I'm paying the collected sales tax from my client for everything that I have purchased, including my work. Is that what you're talking about or something else?
Well, not exactly. I mean, this is just a retail outlet. What they do is they charge you the sales tax because they have to charge you sales tax. They have to give the sales tax to New York State. But they've set up a deal with a credit card company whose reason behind it, my guess would be, they have rather exorbitant interest rates. They have something ridiculous like 30% above prime rates. Now, if you are foolish and you don't pay your credit cards on time and you just let the interest accrue, this is going to make you rather poor. But if you spite the credit card company by actually paying off the credit card when it's due, you don't have to pay the exorbitant usury fees and that they use to offset paying you back for the sales tax. So the sales tax is paid, but the credit card company and the retailer have set up an arrangement where if you pay your credit card bills on time, they will give you back all the money that you paid in sales tax, which is a nice deal, I think. They've tried this with two different credit card companies because they've moved on to a second credit card company. My guess is it's because
the
credit card company
radio club
don't find it as lucrative as they thought. They thought more people would be paying off those usury fees, but it doesn't seem to be the case. But still, it's something that's still offered in B&H Photo, and I think it's very nice. You know, you end up paying 8% less ultimately because that's approximately what the sales taxes are.
BHT.
Yes, Jim.
I like the idea. It's intriguing. Most importantly, because it seems like if you use a battery for only one type of purpose, it tends to be shot when you go to use it. I'm dead. And so batteries for multiple purposes, I find it's much more life out of them in the long run. But I'll tell you this. I'd be very scared hooking up a QFRP radio to a device that can put out 20 volts. Having learned the hard way, that can get very expensive very fast. But I think if you pick the right device, the idea has lots of merit.
KD2AMZ, Rabbi. Those devices, you can preset the voltage, so whenever you turn it on, it's either 5, 9, 15 or 20. It can be preset, so you don't have to worry about blowing things up. You just got to make sure you preset it.
Very nice.
Yes, indeed. I thank you, Mike, for adding that as an option. If you attempt it yourself and you want to come back and tell us how it went, I'd love to hear about it.
I would like it. I'm intrigued. I'm doing a little bit of homework, just like everything else. You got to research it first, but it's an intriguing idea. If anybody else wants to experiment, it could be fun.
Yes, I agree. More options are always better than less options. So you've offered us all another option. I've read a curious article of retro repurposing computer power supplies, switching power supplies for amateur radio use. I think that kind of depends upon what era the computer power supply came from. I would imagine a 30-year-old switching power supply from some kind of low-priced computer would probably not be as kind of clean as far as RF is concerned as the modern-day designs for switching power supplies. But, you know, always good to hear new options as ways of repurposing and doing things in different ways.
I will keep the group advised.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Mike. Thank you for that information. Anyone with any other comments before we move on? Very well. Next on my list is Paul, WS2N.
Okay, WS2N. YALL sends out information. And they talk about DX, of course, every now and then. And they talked about the Bouvet Island DX position. Now, Bouvet Island is the rarest, one of the rarest entities that you can get. They said the second, you know, on the top of the list, the first is North Korea, but chances of getting that is going to be nil to none. So they have this expedition that went out there, and they're there now. And as of a couple of days ago, they had around 5,000 QSOs already, and they were working CW and USB, 17 meters and 15 meters. But they're going to work other bands as well. The reason I bring it up is because one of the modes they're going to use is FT8. Now, I'm not capable of doing that right now. Not with this radio. But I know a lot of you guys are, and I guess you could put FT8 on and look up Bouvet Island Expedition. I guess you'd have a chance of getting that entity. Let me drop it. Anyway, the call that they use is 3YOJ. 3Y Yankee Oscar Juliet. You put that call, the exposition, in, and you get all kinds of information about what's going on. They have a team there now. They went by boat. And then, from what I understand, there's a storm there. And so right now, they're taking the antennas down. And I'm sure after that, they'll put it back up. They took this boat, and I'm not sure how many people are on the team. But it's very rare island. Like I said, it's halfway between South Africa and the Antarctic. And it's actually, if you look at the globe, it's the furthest southern island, you know, in the world. So Bouvet Island, the expedition, let me drop it. And they're actually named the expedition in honor of this astronaut that died years ago. His name's Charles Brady. Charles Brady was an astronaut that went up on Columbia shuttle when they were starting to do the SARex program. The SARex program is a shuttle amateur radio experiment. that's what eventually led to ARIS, Amateur Radio on the International Space Station program, which they have today. But this guy, I mean, he was a regular ham. A lot of these astronauts, they get their license when they're astronauts, and that's why you see a lot of five calls. But this fella had the N4BQW, N4 Bravo Quebec Whiskey call letter. And he came back and retired from NASA. And he himself would go on these de-expeditions to different places. One of these fellows that really loved ham radio. But unfortunately, he died at a younger age. I think he was in his young 50s. But anyway, they named it after him. But Bouvet Island, de-expedition, I guess if you get on FT8, you'd have a chance of getting that. I'm not sure how long the team is going to stay there. But like I said, if you put that call in, I guess you can get news updates as time goes on. Anyway, back to you, Roy. WS1.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Paul, for that. Yeah, I got the ARRL email. Interesting little island. But basically, FT8 is probably the best way of getting there. Radio-wise, it's very forgiving of compromised antennas and even somewhat limited power. Although there are people out there that kind of, it was never designed as a full legal power protocol. It was meant as a kind of a low signal, a QRP type of thing. But there are people who use full legal 1.5 kilowatts on FT8. If you're so inclined, FT8 is not that difficult to figure out. It just requires a radio that you can pipe the audio into your computer and out again, and a good time synchronization program, because you have to have the time set correctly on your computer, because these packets are sent at a certain time, each minute on the second. So if you haven't checked out FT8 before, that's named after two gentlemen, Frank and Taylor. Taylor being Joe Taylor, the famous WS JT guy who gave us all the new, low-power algorithms and means of moon bouncing without too much trouble and such. So check it out. FT8 is a fascinating protocol that's being used a lot. If you ever wander by the frequency where FT8 tends to be used, it is always busy. I have never seen it silent.
Okay. And if you run an FT8 and you see a...
Welcome to the Long Island Amateur Radio Club repeater system.
Something that starts with 3Y. 3Y. Juliet, you've... You've nailed it anyway, but trying to get it with CW and or voice, on 20 or something, it's going to be tough. Doable, in fact, if you find out what frequency they're on, you have to go up five. You won't be able to transmit on their frequency. It'll be split. Anyway, back to yours.
Very good. With FT8, though, there's something called, I think it's called JT Helper. It's a complementary piece of software to FT8 where you could set up alerts so that if it'll scan the band where FT8 for a given, 10-meter frequency range and the 20-meter frequency range. And if it registers a certain call sign or a certain area, it will alert the person on the computer screen so that it makes it even more obvious. I mean, It's almost completely self-controlling at this point, which just kind of defeats the purpose of any kind of challenge. But still, it makes life easier for those people who just want to make that contact. So, keep in mind FT8, and if you're going to use FT8, you might look into things like JT Helper as well.
Okay, on this one website, not the ARRO website, a different one. They actually have the cost, and how much money it costs to put these people on that island, and it's all done through donations and stuff, from companies and private entities. You want to know what this thing costs?
Sure, I'm sure it's semi-ridiculous, I've kind of seen previous articles where guys are kind of explaining how much it costs and suggesting that the rest of us put a couple of bucks ahead for it, but feel free.
Okay, yeah. They have $650,000. I see that on one website. I figure, well, let me look on another one, see if I can find that, which I did, and you start to doubt what you're reading sometimes, but that's what it costs. It's a big deal, I guess. Back to you.
Well, yeah, I mean, if you think about it, they're not kind of setting up a card table, a single a radio, a piece of wire, and a generator. They're setting up tents, places to short-term live, and this is one of those out-of-the-way places. So even if you were just kind of going to transport yourself a radio, an antenna, and a card table and a chair, it would probably end up costing you $10,000, $20,000. It's not like there are regular airline packages that take you to this island. So it's not that surprising. Part of me is surprised that it's important enough for people to put that type of money together. But I guess if it's a bunch of individuals kind of putting together the money so that the opportunity is there, that's very kind and generous of them for the rest of the people who are interested in tagging that particular contact. But yeah, it seems rather expensive to me. But you could explain it by the infrastructure that's necessary and the totally outlandish, out of the way location it exists in.
I can imagine the planning too. They had to buy mountain climbing equipment. They have to go up a cliff at some point for some reason. I don't know if it was right after they got off the boat or, that's the other thing. They have to hire this boat to do this. And they've got to go hundreds and hundreds of miles to get to this. And then on top of that, it's bad weather. Right now, of course, it's in the summer mode down there, opposite from here. So I guess that helps. Probably never do this in the winter. And the island is owned by Norway. It's not far enough south where it comes under the Antarctica agreement, where Antarctica, no country could really own it. They have a treaty for that. But this one is, just falls short of qualifying for that treaty. So Norway controls it. But, there's nobody there. I mean, it's just an island, and there are now hams. Back to you, Roy.
Yeah, I think there was a Norwegian expedition that discovered it and explored it, so I guess they get rights to it. But, as you mentioned, the Antarctic is a kind of international environment, and it's used by some of the more paranoid flat earthers as part of a scheme that is an entire either civilization or a massive amount of arable land hidden away past the Antarctic border. The reason that the powers that be signed that treaty is to limit us the ability to go there. You could get as much land and grow as much things and be a wealthy farmer, I guess. I don't know. It's occasionally interesting listening to flat earthers go on their half-baked theories. But they have a special place in their heart for the Antarctic, which they think is an ice wall that surrounds the entire flat pancake planet Earth.
Yeah, right. Okay. They say it's the coldest desert. By the way, I said a couple hundred miles. It's 900 miles south of South Africa, south of land. Okay, back to you. I just wanted to bring this up. I don't have all this radio is acting up, so I can't even get on 20. If they want 40 and 80, I might have a chance. Of course, to go all the way to the South Atlantic, I don't think so. Back to you.
Oh, well, I wish them well. There have been previous expeditions that unfortunately had to be shut down prematurely due to very bad weather. Usually these out-of-the-way places are not just out-of-the-way, but they're close to not very hospitable to humanity in any way, shape, or form. So I wish them luck, and I hope everyone has a fun time making a lot of contacts. It's a success. We'll have to see how things work out. Thank you, Paul, for bringing it up, though. People out there who either are into FT8 or are curious about FT8, this would be a perfect excuse to wet your whistle and try it out. It's really not that complicated. Okay, thank you, Paul. Next on my list for tonight is Jim, KD2VHD. What's your topic for tonight or question?
KD2VHD. I wanted to touch on the balloons that you mentioned. I've been following that story closely as is practical, but mostly first from a technological angle. What are these things and what are they doing? It's very intriguing, and so obviously we have a sketchy story. But it occurred to me this afternoon that we've just put the F-22, the ungodly expensive top-of-the-line fighter, up against these things, these probably telemetry machines, three times. So whoever has these devices up there has just had first-person telemetry on, say, the F-22 in operation, first three kills ever. Basically, we're shooting rats with an M1 Abrams tank, and it was incredibly expensive.
Yes, Ed?
I know a fair amount about the F-22, and to answer the initial question, they are so specialized that they haven't really been needed. So they weren't chosen because for any other reason than they're being kept in reserve for something that hasn't happened, so why not let them play?
Yeah, I mean, that's quite correct. I mean, the pilots need exercise, planes need exercise, and you want to stretch them, and you want to show off also for the audience. There was a lot of questioning of why are we allowing the Chinese spy balloon to just float across the continental United States, and I think everyone sort of decided that the first time that they see anything floating around that they don't know quite what it is, they're going to shoot the darn thing down. And most likely they're also jamming it simultaneously, so I'm not really that concerned that they're going to discover some great secret about our military might from it. I'm not even quite sure what the other objects are. The first one that we talked about last week, it was a large balloon with a great deal, with a solar cell array and a lot of spy equipment. Through the week, I read little bits and pieces where they had found devices capable of picking up RF. So it kind of goes along with my understanding that the benefit of a relative low altitude balloon as opposed to a satellite, it's much more amenable to capturing local RF signals.
definitely, we sort of, we know what that is. That was a spy balloon. I don't think we know what these other things are. No one has yet to really explain it in a way that makes any sense. They've kind of third party mentioned what some pilots who were speeding past it at supersonic speeds might have thought it might have been. Nothing definitive. I mean, hopefully it's not going to be classified. Hopefully we'll have some further information as the week